Disclaimer. The views and opinions you hear expressed by the participants in the show are not the views of AnimeNewsNetwork.com. Enjoy the show. Everybody, welcome to AnCast. I'm Zach Birchie. Joining us again after a multiple-year hiatus, it is the crew from ColonyDrop.com, the only pink-themed anime blog that updates a couple times a year. I'm very happy to have you guys back on the show. It was great fun talking to you last time. We've got Sean.
What's up, guys?
Matt, who is apparently in a park in Tokyo, so if you hear a little background noise, that's what that is. Matt, thanks for coming on.
Hey, good morning.
And, of course, our favorite, he also writes Astro Toy for AnimeNewsNetwork.com. It's David Cabrera. How's it going, man?
Hey, guys, what's up?
So we'll talk about the zine in a little bit, but we haven't had you on in a while, and, looking at the site, pretty infrequent updating, but every time you do it, it always gets a lot of attention. So I sort of wanted to know what's going on with the site. Are there plans to be updating more often? How's it going over there?
Well, that's a good question. I think mostly we've all been doing different non-anime stuff or just other hobbies.
What?
And so it's one of those things that we're not giving up on it, but we're not really going to keep forcing content out if it doesn't feel worthwhile.
Wait, Sean, isn't the excuse here we're working on the zine? Isn't that the kind of PR thing to say?
That was the excuse for 2 years, but I think we've run out of
yeah.
Mileage.
There's only
on that
so
one.
Much you can redirect. I mean, what's our streak right now?
We've got a post back from March, I think.
I think the last one on the front page is actually from June of last year. So it's a full year.
No, I forced a post a little while back last season with the short stuff.
Maybe.
I woke up one day and said, Colin Drop certainly hasn't been updated in a long time. And I watched like 10 or however many 3-minute shows and whipped something up. But that spark doesn't hit so often. Am I right, guys? Am I right? The spark
right.
Magic?
That's right. I think Jeff also did a post about my little sister is too cute to imagine or whatever.
Oh, yeah. We got a lot of response from that, actually. Because both our reader base and our dislikes us reader base were both shocked and awed. So, mission accomplished.
Yeah,
gotta piss off everybody.
We got some questions about that particular entry. But it sounds like maybe the blog itself it just isn't being updated as often. But are you guys still watching anime? I mean, what have you been watching? I'm curious because. Obviously, the site is notable for being sort of, I want to say caustic, or at least very direct, and, that's kind of what people want to hear about. So I sort of want to go around the table here and see what you've been watching and get your take on it. David, can we start with you?
Yeah, sure. What have I been watching consistently this season? I think what's changed for me is that I'm no longer watching stuff week to week, with the possible exception of DD Fist of the North Star, because I love Fist of the North Star, and DD Fist of the North Star is actually funny, which is an extreme, extreme rarity in anime comedy, period. If you're not familiar, it's by Akitaro Daichi, who's done Child's Toy, gag manga one, that's really good. A bunch of legitimately funny comedy anime that have jokes and stuff. And to have him, with his style, do one of my favorite things, obviously I'm on board there. I started a couple of the shows that are running. I started all the robot stuff. I'm enjoying Majestic Prince the most. I watched the first episode of Valvrade and said, yeah, I know what you guys are up to, and closed the window. Hmm. And what's the other? And Gargantia is on my queue, but I haven't started on it. If anything, I just keep up with Japanese children's superhero shows now.
Right, that is a particular focus of yours. And it would seem to me, if I may be so bold as to indicate a trend, there isn't
I think so.
There isn't one right now that you are loving quite as much as you loved the last Kamen Rider, the one from last year?
Oh, yeah, Forze I loved. Forze is the greatest. Well, the reason I'm watching the current Super Sentai right now is the current Super Sentai is called Kyuriger. And it's by the same gang that did Fours, and it has that same really exaggerated, jokey direction and general good times attitude, which is kind of what I want in anime in general and don't get very often, which is why I'm watching Majestic Prince, which is a very late 90s goofy super robot cartoon about a goofy guy and his stupid friends who fly super robots, and that's basically it. I guess my expectations have lowered 3 years of watching anime, and I'm kind of happy with that sort of thing. It's like, whatever, give me Majestic Prince. I don't care what happens in like earth-shaking plot twist in Sunrise Shoei. I just can't anymore.
Right, you want something that's maybe a little bit less ambitious, a little more low-key.
Something with a sense of joy, fundamentally. DD Fist of the North Star has a sense of joy. In the first episode, Kenshiro tries to work at a construction firm and takes down the house with his special moves. And then he says to the foreman, "I've done my job, please thank me." The best thing about DD Fist of the North Star is that it casts these superhero hulking brutes as very dumb children who don't know anything about the world on a fundamental sense, because they're men who are meant to live in the post-apocalypse working a convenience store. There are a lot of common things they don't understand, like pay or karaoke or shoplifting. And it creates a lot of comedy.
Okay.
I think that's it for me.
I wanted to ask, have you been, since you're the giant robot guy, have you been checking out any of the giant robot stuff? Although there might only be one over on Anime Souls.
I watched the first episode of Tobikage, and I really like it. The thing, Anime Souls, like, the site sort of makes me sad in a sense that they've uploaded all the stuff that I want to watch, but I have so little faith that any of that stuff's going to reach its goals that in turn it makes me less likely to contribute to the project. And it's like this self-eating train of doubt where, for example, I don't think anybody can buy Yatterman. I think even like the person who's chipping in on the first box set for Yatterman, or mine, there are two Yattermans. There's new Yatterman and old Yatterman, each of which is a 100-episode show being sold in like 13-episode chunks, fair enough. For like, what are the goals per box set? I think the show has to make 20K.
Right.
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah. I don't know if there's like anybody who can fund the entirety of Yatterman. And it's kind of like funding the entirety of Scooby-Doo, especially because Yatterman in particular is seriously like the old one, especially. Is very much in like this Hanna-Barbera good guys versus bad guys, here's what's going to happen this week kind of thing. And I don't know if you can pay for 100 episodes of that, but I am going to pay for those Gatchaman Blu-rays when they come out, and that will basically be 100 episodes of that. Tobikage is probably the one I would actually pay for, but the window's closing on all these things. I don't think Tobikage has like Snowball's chance in hell of getting funded. But it's really fun. There are future rectangular-shaped beer glasses was the thing I remembered, because that beer glass was broken over a guy's head about, like, 6 minutes into the episode. And I'm watching anime for bar fights. It's true.
Are any of the Anime Souls projects actually anywhere close to being funded?
Nope. Not even
The furthest one along is Creamy Mommy, but
It's not even a third of the way there. And Yeah, it's a little bit of a shame on that one.
And window's closing for that stuff really soon. I think it's like under 2 weeks at this point.
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised if they relaunch it with a different approach, because I don't whatever that was, it just wasn't quite the right way to do it, I don't think. Anyway, so, Sean, what have you been watching?
Not a whole lot. A lot of baseball.
Okay.
Not a whole lot of anime.
Any anime at all. Anything.
Let's see. The new Pat Labor OAV Blu-rays that came out from one of the former ADV companies. Those are pretty cool. I've been pretty excited about those coming out in Blu-ray in the U.S. Beyond that, I've kind of come to the conclusion that for anime, a lot of what I liked was from a particular aesthetic, and there's not a whole lot of point in me being angry about the fact that aesthetic is gone when I can just watch old stuff again rather than trying to force myself onto new shows. So I kind of pay attention to new shows and new seasons via Twitter and what guys like Dave and Jeff watch. But I usually don't put a whole lot of effort into it myself, unless something really sticks out.
I also experience a lot of anime Twitter vicariously. That's how I'm, and I said this in last week's Toy Column, but that's how I'm experiencing Valvrave. I don't feel the need to actually watch Valvrave when funny people will flip out on the internet over Valvrave, and therefore I've gotten the experience, the emotional rush. Therefore, I've already been entertained by Valvrave.
That's true. That's kind of how I feel too about that show.
Right? Even Sean has feelings about a current major anime. That shows you the power and the range of Valvrave.
It saves a lot of time too if you just read people freak out on Twitter or forums rather than actually having to sit down and watch it.
Well then. Matt, you been watching?
Yeah. So the thing that I do here in Japan, among other things, is write for Otaku USA magazine. So I run their e-newsletter, which the Otaku Magazine US otakuusamagazine.com bugs you to sign up for whenever you go to it. And if you haven't signed up, why haven't you signed up? But basically, we send out a newsletter every couple weeks about stuff going on in Japan. So I go to a lot of theatrical releases.
Oh, okay.
I saw Ghost in the Shell a couple days ago, rather. Hmm. That was awful. And
was it? Well, elaborate, please.
Oh, man. Okay, so I wrote this in Otaku USA magazine, so go and subscribe. But basically, basically Ghost in the Shell has become this very kind of hollow, tropey thing. So first, this thing is just like, okay, the opening shot is some helicopters going over a futuristic city. Okay, at some point, somebody uses thermal optic camouflage in a surprising scene. Okay, the major tries to, like, open a hatch and her arms kind of bust off because that's what she does every time, right? So it's all these shots that kind of are the Ghost in the Shell thing, but they're totally devoid of meaning this time around. It's just, we've got to use this because it's Ghost in the Shell. Aside from that, the animation is pretty substandard. I take that back. It is standard, which I don't think is good enough for Ghost in the Shell. I think it deserves better.
Yeah, I would agree. That sounds disappointing.
Yeah, but, you know, it's the first of four episodes. We'll see what happens, I guess. That's the only kind of optimistic note I can strike on that thing.
But production-wise, shows really tend to put everything they've got in the first episode for that reason. So the quality probably doesn't have a chance, sadly.
No, not really. I mean, it's kind of, some of the shots in that show are so uninventive. It's not even the animation, but just the way things are framed. It was just really disappointing. It was like, oh, this looks like an episode of anime in 2013. And man, if you go back 20 years and look at the first Ghost in the Shell, it's like the series is evolving in reverse. So that film looks so good. Standalone Complex looks pretty good, and that's 10 years old. And Arise looks not any better than a 10-year-old show, you know?
Well, that sucks. I was looking forward to that.
Yeah, sorry. sorry to break the news. The good news is a couple weeks ago, I saw this movie, Hell, which is also Production IG and WIT, who are doing Attack on Titan this season. I guess they're a new studio. And that was filled with a bunch of young or relatively young talent. And it's a, original film. It's not based on a manga or a light novel or anything. And that was like, not great, but it was like pretty okay. And that's rare, you know, to see a film that's not based on it. Well, it, you know, yeah, not based on a previous property to be pretty good like that. So that was cool. And then next month, the new Miyazaki's coming out, which is going to be awesome, probably, I hope. And yeah, the new Katsuhiro Otomo thing, short piece.
Oh, which yeah, is like the, yeah.
Yeah, much like his film Memories. It's like, I think it's four this time, four shorts. So that's exciting.
Yeah, we Justin Savakis saw one of those here in L.A. a little while back, and he really, really dug it. But I tell you, I'm excited about that Miyazaki movie because it looks like he's really breaking new ground. I mean, the trailer just doesn't look like anything else he's ever made. that was a joke.
I sense some sarcasm. I haven't seen the trailer yet. I mean, dude's got his formula, yeah? And yeah. Thankfully, it usually ends up being pretty good. But yeah, we'll see. This is probably his last film, right?
Probably not. Isn't he still in his 70s?
He's in his 70s, yeah. I mean,
he's probably got another one in him.
I think we'll know when Miyazaki's done because he'll burn the building to the ground.
Right, and then he'll climb into a coffin, and then a whimsical plane will take him into the clouds.
Exactly.
Well, that's interesting. So I wanted to talk a little bit about just some of the stuff you guys had been talking about on the blog. But before I do that, since we're talking about what we've been seeing lately, I wanted to ask you guys if you have seen a high-quality film by the name Gyo Tokyo Fish Attack.
No.
I had the chance to see it at Asian Film Fest, and when I saw your vines and tweets about it, I was really happy I didn't pay $13 to go see Gyo Tokyo Fish Attack.
Yeah. So I saw this the other day. It's Aniplex's next release, Aniplex of America. I don't know how much they're asking for it, but I can tell you that whatever they are charging, it is too much. I think it might be one of the worst theatrical productions in anime that I maybe have seen ever. And I don't just mean from content aside, because I was complaining about this movie on Twitter, and someone was like, "Oh well, you've just never seen the manga," and that's not true. I've read at least a couple of volumes of the manga, and it's Junji Ito, but. And I'm sure you guys are familiar with his work. And it's super grotesque horror stuff. But just because the content in the book, and maybe you guys can sympathize with me here a little on this one, just because the content is already in a book and someone has already seen it, that doesn't mean that your first exposure to it needs to be detached hand wave. Oh, well, of course. Well, you just never saw the book. That's why you're shocked by how dumb this is. It's still really dumb. Like, it's still
yeah.
Awful.
It doesn't really follow that train of logic. It was the same thing when I reviewed the Buddha film, yeah, which was terrible, having read the book, and people said the reverse, which was no, you needed to get somebody who hadn't read the books because obviously he would have liked the movie and had a real untainted perspective. It was just a really bad movie though.
Well, this seems to be an increasing thing in anime fandom, where whatever your reaction is, it's because you did or didn't familiarize yourself with whatever the source material was first, and that's why you're having a negative response to it. If you have a positive,
yeah,
it's a matter
exactly.
of no one cares. But if you're like,
it's a matter of adjusting like what reaction I wanted out of you, yeah, and criticizing accordingly.
Yeah, exactly. So it's like, wow, this is bullshit. And they're like, well, you just didn't know about the light novels. And it's like, if I did know about the light novels, would that magically make this not bullshit? Like, like Sword Art Online. You know, I watched that for the first time a couple of months ago, and I regret every minute of it.
My condolences.
And I got a couple, like, well, if you read the light novel, I'm like, look, there's no excuse for this material. Like, it's just the worst. If it's even kind of the same storyline, fuck that shit. But
if you read the light novels is also like a Final Frontier anime fan excuse, because the light novel is the perfect format to hold in high esteem forever if you're a fan and don't speak the language.
It's
because
also,
it can never be reached ever. It's not a case like with manga where, okay, somebody can translate that and put that out. With light novel, very rarely does anybody translate and put it out officially, and that leaves like that bad wiki site with the translations, mm-hmm. and you reading it yourself. Right. Either way, it's like a super indirect experience with the material. So you can just kind of wave it around on the internet, like this platonic ideal of what the light novel good version of the story is. Like in a parallel universe, a good version of Sword Art Online exists and you just haven't found out about it. But here's, 700 pages supplemental material. I think you'll change that, C.
yeah, totally. Well, it also, like you said, it's sort of the final frontier on that front, but it's also the final frontier on I'm more knowledgeable than you, and therefore your reaction to this is invalid because I know more about it than you do, because all this stuff is so accessible now. Like, you can get whatever the hell you want. So that's the last place they can go to be like, well, you just don't know what you're talking about, therefore your opinion is invalid. That's kind of the last place they can go, is this totally inaccessible, impenetrable thing that you wouldn't have known to even look for in the first place. And it, like, that's a lot of the language on 4chan. That's kind of what they use now to dismantle and or dismiss
opinions
of people they don't agree with. But that is kind of the last place they have to go. And once that stuff starts getting like massively translated, like you start getting like light novel translation groups popping up and stuff, that'll go away. They'll have to find something else. But anyway, so Gyo Tokyo Fish Attack isn't just bad because it's a shitty Junji Ito manga. It is also one of the worst-looking theatrical productions I think I've ever seen. Now, I don't know what to normally expect out of UFO Table, but I don't think they normally do work that looks this bad. Now, these guys typically handle the Fate Stay Night, like what's their faces?
Tight Moon stuff. Yeah, they're usually pretty high shelf, so...
Yeah, and this movie looks like trash. Like,
I thought the trailer looked okay from what I vaguely remember seeing of it.
I don't know if it was just the DVD that they sent, but everything looked a little stretched, a little too vertical. The character designs were really unremarkable and off-model in a lot of cases. All the CG was really, really poor. And just so people know what the story's about, a giant swarm of malevolent robot legs takes over the ocean and causes all of the fish to die, and they're sort of mounted on these robot legs, and then this giant swarm of fish robots enters the city, and there's a death stink that permeates, and then people start turning into bloated corpses covered in fish pustules that uncontrollably fart more death stink, and then they turn into corpse-mounted robot leg death fart machines that fart so much that the city... Anyway, Gyo Tokyo Fish Attack, do not watch.
Dude, I totally read this manga. This is a really... I love Junji Ito. He's cool. But the thing about him is, like, you kind of just stare at his kind of grotesque illustrations for a while, and you turn the page and go, oh! You turn another page and go, oh my god. I think it's kind of tough to make that into a film.
Well, yeah, that actually sounds kind of cool to read as a comic, where you're just seeing the sights, and I think filming that would like bring your suspension of disbelief like shattered around you. I don't know. It sounds like a mess to watch as a movie.
Oh, totally.
I was going to say, looking at like screenshots of it, and half the shots are just of like a shark head poking through a window or poking through a doorway. In really bizarre places.
Yep.
So it seems.
They did enjoy using that really poor-looking CG shark model.
Oh, he was a CG shark, too. Lovely.
Yes. Yeah. No, it's chock full of our favorite CG, where they've cut the frame rate to match the 2D animation, so it just looks like total shit.
Oh, yeah.
You know, you would think drawing a shark wouldn't be that hard. I can understand using robots for CG, but I feel like a shark is a relatively simple enough shape that they probably could have just... Yeah, they probably could have just winged that one.
You'd think. So that's coming out pretty soon here, and I do not recommend it.
I saw the box art, and I was confused that it was an Aniplex release, because it looks like the box art, the like schlocky B-movie thing that they have going there.
It looks
like something that Sentai would put out for like $12.95. but it's Aniplex, so I thought that was interesting. Like, maybe they're trying something else. Maybe they're trying to Media Blasters it a little bit.
Well, if they were trying to Media Blasters it, they would just never put it out.
That's true.
No,
we have announced Tokyo Fish Attack.
The cover looks like an Asylum Films release, that is for sure. But if they're going for something a little more low budge, then I guess I can appreciate that. But it's a weird release. I don't know why they're doing that, but it was not a good film. So I want to talk a little bit about some of the stuff you guys have been talking about on the blog, and we got a lot of questions about this. But one of your most recent entries. Relatively recent is about Ori Emo, and it got this sort of weirdly positive response that I think people weren't expecting, because that show has become not only the endless source of one particular kind of joke, where now everyone on Twitter is just constantly my little blank can't be this blank, just and it you know
not gonna lie, still not tired of that joke.
I'm still not tired of it either. It's still funny to me. But it has also become kind of the poster child for, like, hey, here's what kind of sucks about anime right now is, like, this. But then the show itself, honestly, you know, most people who sit down and watch it, I've found, just didn't really find it to be all that bad. Now, I assume you guys have read the spoilers on what happens.
Matt and I did a story on that for the OUSA newsletter. From the perspective of people who knew nothing about it. Really? It was really... I did most of that article, and it was like a really fascinating read through all the spoilers. I had expected the reaction to that article to be more in line with the kind of like really insane anger that I was seeing on like 4chan A and on Animesuki and so on. But every single comment that we got on that blog post was just... Yay! They got together.
What?
I found that really fascinating.
Wait. Really?
Really. Dead serious. One of the most recent comments, like way after the point, was, you know, you writers just don't understand real love.
I think that's the other way around.
Yeah.
Holy shit. Oh my god.
So blogging anime is always interesting, I tell you.
Yeah, wow. But we did get some questions about that, and I was sort of curious myself, like, looking at that article, you know, now that you know how it wraps, does that change your mind?
Jeff wrote that article, and he's not here, but I can tell you what he said immediately after we were asked that for this podcast.
Okay.
Jeff said, no, this is all completely consistent with what I thought Oremo already was.
Oh, okay. So he... Because when that show came out, a lot of people were like, oh, this is satire. Because anime fans, I think, by and large, do not understand what satire is. Everything that's terrible gets called satire, or, oh, this is parody, as though they don't think that they exist in a world where something like that could be made sincerely, even though 9/10 of it is. and it was brushed off as like, this is playing with the tropes of the... No. It's sincere. Like, this is totally sincere. It is not riffing on anything. And now that it ended, people are saying, like, oh, what the fuck? Like, they're shocked and taken aback that, wait, this actually was a horrible incest thing?
Yeah. Despite what it said on the cover. Mind blown.
Despite what it says on the cover and what the show does in every episode.
It's right there, gang.
Yeah, so his attitude towards that article is basically like, I figured it was going to be like that.
I don't know how you end something with that title serving that audience without, like, giving them the service they've clearly demanded throughout, like, however many books it is. I mean, to assume that the majority of the audience is coming at something ironically is probably not a good way to have, like, an anime mega hit. Just saying.
What was that, the manga series about the teacher and the really young girl that...
Kodomo no Jikan, which also ended the same way.
But that was also a show, like a series that people would kind of defend and say that it wasn't really as bad as you thought it was, and it was kind of sweet, and it's not creepy at all. And then, of course...
Yeah, and what's so weird about this? I'm not seeing it, like that kind of thing.
You're just a prude. You know, speaking as the guy who single-handedly killed that series...
Yes, you do. Good call.
Chances in America. That does seem to be the thing where, you know, something will have this really creepy-ass premise that's clearly going in one direction. It's obviously not satire. And everyone's like, no, it's not really that bad. Oh, you just don't understand. You just don't get it. You just don't know what you're talking about. And then, of course, it eventually goes there. And they're like, oh, well, you know, like, you know, they it's just like, nothing to see here, folks. Like, hey, back off. It's just kind of a strange phenomenon. But aside from Oreimo, I did want to talk about this a little bit. Last year, you guys wrote about Lupin the Third, a woman named Fujiko Mine. Or, Dave, you did.
Yeah, that was one of mine.
And that's coming out here in the States. And I'm actually curious to revisit it. I do want to see the dub. I want to see what they did with that. And I liked that show okay enough. But you called it overly ambitious. And I think that sort of crystallized that show for me. And I'm curious, now that it's coming back out, do you have any reflections on that show? And
you know, despite my review, or possibly because of my review, I actually totally want to go back to that show. I want to watch it again, because my frustration with it was one thing, but it was mostly a thing that entertained me and made me happy throughout. I really enjoyed almost all of those episodes of Lupin the Third and think they did a great job with it. And that's another thing that I'll totally buy, but boy, that ending. Even though I fully understand like what they were trying to say and do with that ending, and I even love the message that they were gunning for, which is basically Fujiko is not damaged goods, fuck you. And I love that spirit, but I really could have done without the ending of a JRPG.
That's a good point. Hey, yeah. Now I'm looking forward to revisiting that. Matt, Sean, you guys have opinions on that show?
I thought for a while.
I mean,
go ahead.
Sorry, go ahead, Sean.
I thought it was hilarious. For a while, one of our friends had pointed out that both Colleen Drop and the blog AnimePages, which is a really great blog about animators and animation in Japan, both of our last posts had been Fujiko for like 6 months. And the joke was that series had killed both of these blogs. And I guess AnimePages still hasn't updated, but we finally did.
AnimePages even episode blog Fujiko. He went far. He went hard on that. And then, poof. Though, well, we shouldn't get to the scene.
Basically, my thought is like, I will take overly ambitious and a little bit flawed over just stale any day of the week, you know?
Yeah. Hey, Flowers of Evil, right?
Dude. Yeah, I want to talk about Flowers of Evil. I saw you got a question about that for us.
We'll get to that here.
Cool.
Before we get to Twitter, obviously we need to talk about your magazine. So, you guys are putting out what I think could adequately be described as the most hotly anticipated fan-produced anime zine in America. And that's because it's probably the only fan-produced anime zine, like actual print publication, coming out. And I want to know, first, why? And secondly, what is the passion behind this project? I say none of this with the implication that I think it's a waste of time or I think it's a bad idea. I used to work in print, and I miss it. And I think it's really cool that you guys are putting a zine out, but I'm curious, where's it coming from?
Well, first of all, I should just point out that there is actually one other fanzine that did just come out in, I think, December or November of last year. Carl Horn released a 25-year anniversary fanzine for Royal Space Force Oniamis, also through MagCloud, that is exceptionally good. I mean, I'm not sure if how many people are familiar with Carl Horn's writing outside of editing for manga and stuff, but he is a phenomenal writer, and he knows Gainax history probably better or as well as anyone else in the English-speaking world. And I would really recommend people pick up that fanzine because it's kind of it does a great tribute to a really good movie that doesn't get a whole lot of attention in the U.S. and that just got announced for a re-release on Blu-ray. But as for the background for the fanzine, I think for us, none of us had actually grown up in a period when fanzines were really that common. All of us kind of got into anime in the late 90s. Why at that point there had been the internet and more professional magazines had started coming out. But we liked the idea, and we kind of liked the idea of kind of calling back to that time period. And so I don't remember how even the topic first came up, but at some point early on in the first couple of years of Colony Drop, someone would start kicking around the idea of doing a fanzine, because we were kind of getting popular enough that it could kind of be feasible. And with print-on-demand services like MagCloud, which are kind of more expensive than probably if we had done pre-printing, I mean, the beauty of it is that you can put it up there, and if people want it, they can buy it, and there's no real risk of investment from us, because when we released our first one in 2011, we weren't really sure if people were actually going to want it. And I kind of really was not thrilled about the idea of having 50 or 100 copies printed up and just sitting in my living room and being stuck with them. And so I think for kind of little vanity publications like that, print on demand offers kind of a decent alternative to letting people that are still kind of into print actually make print productions without a huge risk or without much overhead.
Right. And so what's the overhead on this in terms of for your production? Like, how many people do you have working on it? It's pretty well laid out. Like, it's a good looking magazine. I'm personally pretty impressed with it. Do you have someone who's a professional designer doing this? Is it just a hobbyist? I mean, who's putting this thing together? Because it looks good.
Oh, thank you. That was actually I did the layout for it. And I've taken a few classes in design and stuff, but I'm not anywhere near a professional designer. I kind of just started copying stuff that I thought looked good. Mm-hmm. But I mean, with the way it is, I mean, you can design things in InDesign. You can do it in probably word processors as well. So it's one of those things where if you're relatively competent with the computer, I feel like it's probably not a huge effort to put together a PDF that you can send away to a MagCloud and have printed up.
Well, but I mean, there's a definite art to page layout.
Yeah.
I don't think it's not just like, anyone can do this well. It's like, no, you have to have some eye for the page. And I mean, you say you're just sort of copying what you think looks good, but it's a very good looking magazine. And
thank you.
It's just impressive that such a small team can put together something that would hold up against, I would say, certainly what. However few anime magazines are actually left. Actually, I think Otaku USA is the only one.
Is Neo in the UK still around?
Yeah, actually, I was in a Barnes & Noble. Hey, a Barnes & Noble, it's still open. just the other week, and Neo was there. But, I mean, they're importing that, so...
Right. Yeah, it probably costs like $15 or something.
Yeah, you can get it, but I think it's that and Otaku USA are basically it. So it's just, I don't know, it's interesting to see just such a small team being able to get something together. And, you know, admittedly, it's niche, and the content in the magazine itself is definitely aimed at your audience, which is old-timers like me and even older-timers.
Right.
Timers older than ourselves, even.
Yes. Yeah.
Well, I mean, I think there's an issue, if you look at, like, the history of fanzines and anime magazines in the U.S., is that when they first kind of started off, you had a lot of anime titles that were available and fan-traded, you know, videotapes, but they didn't have subtitles. And so, like, old issues of Animag from, like, the late 80s, they don't even have real, you know, articles or reviews. It's just summaries of what's going on. Yeah. So it's like something you would read along with or something you would read before watching it. And then it kind of moved on to reviews. And I feel like there's always kind of been this empty space where you have, on one hand, you have, like, a modern kind of the anime school bit, you know, like the more scholarly approach where you have publications like Mechademia that take it from a very academic point of view. And then you have Otaku USA, which is more kind of review focused and just on, you know, what's new and reviews of those things. And there's nothing really in between to talk about other kind of issues or other kinds of stories or kind of go at it from a more original point of view. And I think the content part of it was just the fact that we realized, you know, a lot of new anime fans, why would they, or younger anime fans, aren't going to want to buy anything in print, full stop. So we might as well kind of more appeal to to the people that are on board with us already. And the other part is just the people that we're friends with and people that we contacted to write for us. That's just kind of what they ended up wanting to write about and what they sent into us.
The other nice thing about print on demand is, frankly, not having the expectation of, like Sean said, having to sell 50 copies or whatever, though I'm sure we sold 50 copies, but not the expectation of having to sell X number of copies and, like, having to do content that will specifically reach people. And we can just, we, even though I didn't write on this, we in the plural can write what we want to write for the hell of it. The piece right. I did for the last scene was a creepy fictional story about a creepy guy playing Bubblegum Crash. I'm sorry, on the PC Engine and being very sad with his experience.
Right.
I probably wouldn't have even done that on the blog.
No, part of what we wanted to do with the zine was to write articles that wouldn't necessarily be for blog posts, or wouldn't be something we'd post on the website, or something that were a bit, you know, things were a bit longer. Like we had the writing being novella and stuff that we never posted in its entirety on the website, and just things like that that were kind of more deserving of being in print and, you know, actually sitting down and reading rather than just a blog post.
Even the people who bought the zine often didn't get the joke of the writing being novella. They just thought that there was all this weird... They thought that there was just this weird story in the back of the book that, like, somebody's fan fiction or something. It's like, no, that's actually writing being. We just yep. wrote out writing being for you. Enjoy.
And, I mean, to be honest, like, Mark is a phenomenal writer, and he did a really good job of actually doing, like, a legitimately good novelization of that OAV.
Very noirish.
Yeah, and yeah. I mean, he complained about having to rewatch scenes because all the dialogue in the novella is taken from the English dub. So he had to rewatch every scene, he said, like 5 or 10 times just to get the dialogue down and to do it. And so I think at the end of it, he was pretty tired of writing Bean. But
you know, that's I remember because I have the first one. My copy of the second one hasn't shown up yet. But I remember seeing that and thinking it was a really good idea to do. If someone just had the cojones to actually print these, to take, especially it'd be great with like modern anime or going back to maybe some older stuff, classic 80s and 90s kids movie novelization, you know, where they'd be like with 8 color photos from the movie, like in the middle there's glossy pages that have like stills. Right. It's all real hacky writing that just sort of summarizes the film in sort of a narrative form. I think if you did that with some, like that would be a fun thing to do that would amuse me and maybe 5 other people.
The light novel.
Yeah, right. Well, yeah.
Mark,
I'll get
Mark
on.
Mark even did stuff like, I think there was one scene where he talks about Percy, who is the cop who's chasing Writing Bean, and he talks about how he spent his early 20s slogging through shit in Vietnamese rice fields, and now he was slogging through shit in the streets of Chicago, and just like little bits of backstory like that. They're kind of, you know, kind of unnecessary, and then kind of in that ridiculous novelization kind of way that I right. thought made it really work.
Yeah, little
and tidbits. Things that you have to have a certain appreciate or a certain kind of humor to really appreciate stuff like that. But I thought it worked pretty well.
Yeah. So people can get this. People can get this magazine. Just head on over to colonydrop.com. It's the most recent blog
yep.
entry, which I'm sure will not be replaced anytime soon.
Yeah.
Yeah, we'll ride on that for a bit.
Yeah.
And for a second, Zach,
the other thing that going back to this current issue number 2 is like something that you and Justin have talked a lot about on the Ancast is keeping a record of anime fandom in the States. Yeah, I think two or three of the articles in volume 2 are specifically about anime fandom in the States and how that evolved, and which I think, frankly, is kind of at times far more interesting than talking about actual anime itself, is like the fans that got into it when it was hard to get into and that kind of thing. So,
yeah, no, I noticed.
Yeah. As you guys talked about, a couple podcasts ago, some of these people are unfortunately passing away, kind of the earliest, American anime fans. And it's kind of important to get this stuff down.
Yeah, it's a sad thing because, you know, it when people who are, you know, kicking off in their 50s and 60s, who were in their 30s in the 80s, we want to preserve that. And I noticed that about the list of articles here. You've got one on VHS, specifically the title says the VHS-based lifestyle of fans during the Reagan administration. Like, this is history that... You know, maybe not so many people care that much about, but it's really important to have it recorded somewhere. Yeah. And I'm glad that this exists and people can actually learn about it, because it was completely different back then. And this reminded me that somewhere in a box, somewhere in my house, there is a flyer from the 80s from my college anime club that had existed since like 1983 or something like that. And I absconded with one of their printouts that was, it was a dot matrix printout of, they had, I guess that day's programming was a couple episodes of Ranma 1/2, not subtitled, and then like the first two Kimigori Orange Road episodes. And it has, it's these breathless dot matrix synopses of the episodes. So just so you could understand what was happening in the episode. I still have that somewhere. I need to find that and scan it in. But that's the kind of history that's just, it's going to be lost if we don't actually preserve it. And it's good to see that you guys are interested in doing that too. So it's a cool thing.
Yeah. Daryl Surratt wrote a, sorry, John, Daryl Surratt wrote a cool piece for us in that too, which is the generation kind of after that, what he calls the lost generation, which is you've got the internet, but it's way too slow to download anime or something. So it's the kind of BBS weird middle ground thing, which I think is pretty cool.
Right.
Every so often, if you were lucky, you would score an episode on real media.
Yeah.
And you considered that like a real serious boon. You would you'd leave the phone on overnight for that shit.
I
was going to say, on the other hand, there's another article, or it's a discussion with a friend of mine named Renato Rivera, who is a guy who lives and teaches in Japan, and he had shown interest, or he had communicated his interest in contributing something for us, and I was like, yeah, sure, send me something. And a few months later, he sent us this discussion between him and a couple of Japanese anime journalists, who are a couple of guys. I've never heard of them. I don't think they're particularly really well known at all in the U.S. just because of how things go. Ryota Fujitsu and Keisuke Hirota. And they've both written for magazines. I think they've both written books about the history of anime and different aspects of it. And their discussion largely centers on anime magazines in Japan and about the evolution and kind of how that became more merchandised, and then about what it's like working in that industry now and how controlled it is by the companies that make the actual animation. And stuff like that probably isn't going to blow anyone's mind that's kind of familiar enough with how messed up the Japanese animation industry is. But I thought it was kind of cool that it's actually getting in there, and it's getting in English, and it's the kind of thing that you never really see in print in English, kind of that aspect of industry over there.
When Sean sent me the rough copy of the mag, I was completely bowled over by that article, even though it's true. The information is basically understood in an unspoken way. You'll never see that situation like described in such detail in English. I think that's the don't miss article of the zine.
It probably deserves to be in a more widely read publication. And part of it, I wonder, is if those guys were so honest because they knew it was just going into an English fanzine and not, you know, it wasn't distributed in Japanese at all. But there's a lot of interesting talk there about the 80s and how much things changed there towards the OAV era, and then how like magazines like New Type took on kind of a more merchandising approach, and where it wasn't so much about convincing new fans to watch these new shows. It was about appealing to the fans that already existed to these shows. And so I thought that was kind of fascinating.
Well, I mean, New Type, Animage, all that stuff, that those magazines and the Japanese entertainment press in general is an extension of the PR branch of anime companies. They operate entirely at their behest and at their approval. And so that's why you don't see things like reviews or opinion on anything other than, this looks great, everyone go buy it. Like, and that's it.
I know what you're talking about. Famitsu's scores are held in the highest esteem in video game circles.
Yeah.
Everybody knows that.
You gotta wait for that Famitsu score before you decide.
That 10 out of 10 is a seal.
And in that same vein, in Carl Horn's Oniami's fanzine, some of the articles he has, one of them is about like the creation of Oniami's and kind of Gainax's original proposal to Bandai for this film. And I forget, it's one of the most depressing articles I think I've ever read about anime, just in terms of the reason why they wanted to make Onyamis was to make a more realistic, a more humanistic approach that wasn't as driven by merchandise. And it basically sounds like the same complaints that a lot of people are having about anime now. And you realize that that's just been going on for 30 years. Where, you know, even if we blocked it out or if we weren't aware of it, all of these issues aren't exactly new issues.
Since that first guy bought every VHS tape from the video rental place of, I don't know, Minky Momo. we've all been paying for it since. He paid a grand, and
yeah, as soon as they're willing to pay, you know, $100 per VHS tape, we were all kind of fucked.
Okay, let's go ahead and get to Twitter, guys.
All right.
Zump1 asks, which anime from the 80s and 90s have you thought about covering in future articles for either the fanzine or the site? Slayers. You want to say Slayers?
for a long time, I really want to do every Koichi Ohada directed anime, and I think we're relatively close. Not that close, actually.
One of the earliest things, like even sort of pre-Colony Drop, was I was doing this series of all the work of Koichi Ohada. I would just want to go back and take an eraser to the whole thing and start over again, personally. It's been that long. Ohada zine. Sean, weren't you thinking Pat Labor as a subject? I mean, I don't want to like say anything definitively, but...
Yeah. If we do another fanzine, it would definitely be a Pat Labor-focused fanzine. Just because it seems like something that everyone on the crew is into. It's one of those shows that a lot of the people that are into Colony Drop are really into Pat Labor. And we thought it would kind of be fun to do something focused on a specific series rather than just have articles about all sorts of different stuff. So hopefully if that one actually gets made, it will actually take less than 2 years to come to print. But no promises.
Hey, man, just a hobby.
Yep.
We did a series maybe 2 years ago called Area 88, which is just a bunch of cool stuff from 1988, which we kind of by accident discovered was the coolest year in anime ever. So it might be fun to revisit that and do like a, so it would be 1993 now? Jesus, that would not be very good.
1993, oh boy.
Yeah.
We could do an exclusive on shows with only characters with mauve colored hair.
Yeah, there you go, yeah. But not even a corresponding year, it wouldn't have to be 93, but just pick out another year and do a series on it, that'd be cool.
Yeah, I mean, there's always been a lot of different shows we wanted to do, but the awkward thing is that you kind of have to find an angle that isn't just a boring review of something. You kind of want to find something a little more unique. Well, I will say one show that I'm really looking forward to reviewing is the Love Live Alive movie from Harmony Gold that comes out next month, which kind of counts as a 1980s anime since it's mostly composed of animation from the 1980s.
Next Colony Drop post.
Boom.
I'm looking forward to that.
I've already written most of it in my head. I'm pretty sure I know how that movie's going to turn out.
The forced resuscitation of Robotech.
It is amazing, Sean, how they managed to blend the 80s footage and the current footage so well. It's just amazing.
I'm just having flashbacks to the Zeta Gundam movies where there was just that horrible contrast between the new animation and the old animation. And I figure that if Sunrise and actual Japanese... You know, the people that actually worked on the original series can't make it work. I really don't see Harmony Gold being able to pull that one off.
I remember the character designer for the Zeta Gundam movies apologizing. Like, actually publicly saying, yeah, couldn't get it quite right. The second of those movies opens with a scene that actually cuts from new to old animation in the same scene in the same room. The characters just transform into different people, and you're kind of expected to deal with it.
That's
yeah, I really
great.
Don't see how it's going to work. But
all right. Okay, GBUFO asks, thoughts and opinions on Flowers of Evil and the controversy that the anime started.
Yeah, dude. So this goes back to what you're talking about earlier with the Junji Ito thing. People saying... Well, you haven't read the manga, or it's not like the manga. So Akunohana, you know, for those who don't know, is this rotoscoped thing, you know, drawing over live-action animation like recent, you know, Richard Linklater film, Scanner Darkly.
Yeah.
And people, I guess the controversy is, one, people don't like rotoscoping, and two, it doesn't look anything like the original manga. Number one, yeah, well, okay, I'll talk on about number one later. But number two, as a car goes by, number two, man, if you like the original manga so much, my advice to you is read the original manga again. You know, it's kind of silly when people want the adaptations to be look exactly like the original source material, not realizing there's an inherent difference between pieces of paper and 24 frame a second video. You know, like, I think the closer people stick to the original material, the kind of more lifeless it ends up being. You've got to take into account that it's a different media. And as far as like the reason they used rotoscoping, I think I'm actually working on a Colony Drop piece, which you don't need to read after you listen to this, but the show, the story lends itself really well to this rotoscoping thing where it's not quite animation, but it's not quite live action. And I think the story of the show lives in that weird kind of murky, shadowy space between the two. So I think it's an improvement on the original manga, frankly. And it looks really cool, I think. It's definitely my favorite show this season. Maybe my favorite show in a couple of years.
I watched the first episode and was kind of turned off by the rotoscoping and never really got back to it, but I wasn't mad at it, so to speak. And later, when everybody was talking about the classroom scene in episode 7, I went ahead and looked up the scene, and I feel like the director is 100% validated by that scene alone. That scene is so well done, has like so much emotion that in a way that conventional like 24 frames a second animation might not have really gotten, like the looks on their faces as they trash that place are, I don't know. That scene's transcendent. It's something. I loved it. So I'm not mad at them at all.
I think at the very least, rotoscoping looks a little bit better than the approach of just doing full 3D characters with cell shading effects that never quite looks right, like the new 009 movie. The character is just like awful in that, and I think at least there's an effort to realize that to try to do something that is a little different that isn't quite as obviously computer driven.
Yeah, we talked about things being overly ambitious. This show is super ambitious, and it's like, it's trying something new, which in 2003 is
2013.
I'm sorry, 2013 is
anime was popular pretty, back then.
remarkable. 2003. Those back in those days. No. This show is really like it's taking chances. The other thing that people don't notice, maybe because they're too busy looking at the rotoscoping, is the background art, which is just beautiful. It's set in modern Japan, and it looks exactly like modern Japan. And people who might say, well, that's easy. You just go take a picture and then draw it. Yeah, try that. I think it's pretty difficult to kind of recreate reality like that. They did a really great job.
Yeah, I mean, I think we're almost done with it. Like, I think the last episode airs next week. And it has been stated that like, they do not want to do a second season, which I'm fine with. That they're just like, okay, we're going to make this one thing. And then that's it. And now that the story is getting to where I think it's saying what it wants to say, I totally understand it. Originally, I thought it was maybe a little meandering. And the show does take quite a long time to get to its point. It's very slow. And you kind of have to be cool with that. But I really like what ultimately it's trying to say. And Hope was just telling me that she had read through the what was available in the comics, and she thinks that where it's going to end is the best place for it to end for the show. It's a good place for it to stop, because that's ultimately what it's trying to say. It's getting its message out there, and then that's it. And I can appreciate that a lot. It's artistically ambitious, and it's not this, will it get a second season? Oh gosh, are we going to get more? It's like, no, this is just this one thing. We get this one thing, and that's it.
I wish more anime creators would settle. even in an ambitious work, I mean, like, settle, because stuff is so hard to get made.
Yeah. I mean, even as this project as it exists currently, I'm still a little shocked it got made.
Yeah. You said meandering. I think that's maybe a good word for it. Maybe deliberate is a kinder word. I think the pacing is pretty exceptional. Yeah, you've got to be prepared for this not to be a regular anime show. But man, thank God it's not a regular anime show. I've seen enough of those. You know, let's try something new.
Yeah, and it's to me it speaks volumes to the homogeny that people expect from this stuff, where it's like, okay, there's 20 shows that are exactly what you want, and then this one thing is not exactly what you want, and you just focus on that and just throw fucking rocks at it and act like it's the devil, because for whatever reason all 21 things have to be exactly what you want. It's not enough that you have the 20.
Right. If you're looking to see a meek schoolboy fall in love with an outgoing girl, man, you got choices. You got options.
Yeah, really.
No other aisle in the video store has so many ways to experience that same story.
Well, I mean, yeah. And I you know, ultimately the message of Flowers of Evil, I think, at least what the show is basically trying to say, is that your bullshit is not interesting. And you think you're edgy and you think that you're unique, and you are not, and the world doesn't care about you. And that is that's kind of what Flowers of Evil is saying.
It's a reasonable sentiment.
It totally is, and probably really uncomfortable for, I would say, a modern generation of younger people to accept. I would say that's a really harsh message for people right now. You know, not exactly palatable to people who, especially anime fans who seem to only want escapism. They just want escapism. They do not want anything other. Not all anime fans, of course, obviously. But it does seem like, you know, in a medium that is chock full of that, something like this, literally the opposite of what most people expect from just about anything that comes out. So, I don't know. We talk about Flowers of Evil every week on this show. Okay. .04. Any specific fanzines from back in the day are you taking influence from?
Not really.
Yeah.
I mean, as I said, just we kind of all missed that, so the fanzine boom. And so for us, it was more about the idea of fanzines rather than any specific fanzines. Although I'd say one of our readers recently sent me a copy of Robotech UK, which was the first anime fanzine in the United Kingdom. Obviously about Robotech, and it wasn't particularly interesting, but one thing that struck me about that was how great the art was for being fan-produced art in the early 1990s. But I wouldn't say there's been any specific influence from any particular fanzines.
We've been very lucky with the quality of art we've gotten for the zine.
Yeah.
Every time, people consistently amaze me.
Yeah, that was the other thing. Like, having worked in print, seeing the art that you do have, I know how big that has to be in order for it to look decent on the page. And in what format you need to be able to get it in, and the transparencies and shit, I'm impressed. It's I'm like, where did you get those assets? Like, that must be tough to get a hold of.
I mean, we were blown away. A lot of the people that illustrated for both of the fanzines both kind of came out of the woodwork and were just emailing us and showing us examples and saying, like, hey, we'd love to draw something for your fanzine. So we didn't really have to beat down on too many doors or hound people for it too much. We just got really lucky with it.
Which is the thing that impressed me so much, that we didn't have to go, that somehow these incredibly talented people were waiting on our asses. It was pretty amazing.
Okay, Byreal asks, for David, as someone who recently moved to New York, what places should an anime fan hit up?
Let's see. Every other week or so, I tend to hit up Midtown on a trip from Kinokuniya Bookstore, which is if you take the F to Bryant Park, you're there already. I'll go to Kinokuniya, look at the things I can't afford, buy something I can, and then walk up to Rockefeller Center around where Book Off is at. Google these places, because I don't have them in my head. Book Off is, I would say, the best and only otaku treasure hunting supply in New York City. not a lot of people know about it. Everything is pretty affordable, especially compared to what you pay for things like new from Kinokuniya or online or pretty much anywhere else you can buy things, with the exception of English language manga, which are overpriced deliberately. And I go there every couple weeks to see what's come in. And most times I don't come away with anything I'm interested in. And every so often I'll come away with like something completely nuts that I never would have found. Like, even though Sean has all of these, I find like old B Club Bubblegum Crisis art books and stuff like that, that somebody just returned a book off. My best find at Book Off was a $100 JoJo's Bizarre Adventure like art book collection called JoJo Agogo, which has all the info on everything JoJo had been released up to that point. It's in a beautiful format. The book itself is this gigantic monster thing with a spinning paper wheel inside that has Araki's face on it. It's super, super deluxe and really silly. And I got it for $15 at Book Off.
The thing about Book Off in New York, Book Off in New York is almost identical to Book Off in Japan, which kind of blew me away. I mean, it is kind of just like walking any of the Book Offs that you would see around Tokyo. It just happens to be in New York.
Yeah, they all are. We have a bunch of them here where I live in Southern California. And having been to, been to plenty of Book Offs in Japan, or in Tokyo, rather. Yeah, it's when I walked into a Book Off in Tokyo, I was like, hey, it's a Book Off. Because I'd been to plenty of them here. It's a remarkably consistent experience.
Yep.
Yeah.
If Japan doesn't want it, find it a Book Off.
Yep, and the ones around here will have the same 1990s art books forever.
Oh, yeah. The other wonderful thing about being in the art book section at Book Off is seeing things dying off in that aisle. Like, the things that disappear immediately in the art book section over there are things from Type Moon and things from Key, which still have really strong fan followings, even though it's been a few years. On the other hand, the things that don't go are like the forgotten franchises of the 90s. Like, for a while, and I think they just threw them out, Book Off, Mike Tool would be sad. Book Off had a whole row of Sakura Taisen books from every single game in the series. Like 20 or so Sakura Taisen books. Even the old Super Real Mahjong strip arcade games. There were like 6 or 7 of those because that had their following. All like the kind of proto Moe 90s stuff that, you know, the nature of it is to move on to the next thing. And there those books were.
Yeah, around here, at least my local one, there's a couple dotted around around Los Angeles County and Orange County, but my local one seems to have an abundance of unwanted Evangelion art books from the 90s. So, you know, real bullshit ones, like the ones like no one would ever want.
Like Ava, Book of Merchandise about Ava as of 96.
Yes, that's, yep, that one's there. And
yep.
For some weird reason, Lamune Knight and 40 Fresh stuff, which will never sell to anyone. Lots of Slayers, lots of Lotus War. Yeah, just shit. No one wants it anymore. But it's always fun to go there and then dig through the piles.
Dave, you also wrote about, for Otaku USA, you wrote about a maid cafe that's opening up, right?
There is a maid cafe opening up in Chinatown. Again, this is like right off the Canal Street Station on the R. And it's disguised as a humble froyo business. But they have a little maid dress hanging in the, like behind the counter. When we got there, they hadn't actually like begun maid stuff. But it was because they had begun an elaborate maid auditioning process at that point. So the maids are having interviews. The maids are I guess, learning dances and the Moe Moe Kyun Beam. And I think in a few weeks that maid cafe will open up proper as a maid cafe that sells you froyo and curry and bubble tea. And the bubbles in the bubble tea are a little too sugary for my taste. Like, there's a bit. They taste like candy tapioca bubbles. It's not really what I want in my bubble tea. But I would hang out there. And probably, like, 2 or 3 weeks from now or whenever it starts to go down over there, I will definitely come by. The other thing I mentioned in that article, even though this is of no use to you, reader, because you just moved in, is that, like, throughout the I guess all the way through the 2000s, Chinatown in Manhattan still was, like, kind of a nerd center. Chinatown Fair Arcade was still open. There were other smaller arcades in the area. If you went down Elizabeth Street, there was, like, an otaku mall with the finest in bootleg goods. When Chinatown Fair closed, that entire place stopped being a geek center, which is sad because it used to be my one-stop shop for all that stuff. But as of now, it's not really worth going. The guy at the Chogokin store treated me like a thief. And
So all that stuff closed down? Because I know what you're talking about. When I lived in New York, we used to go there, like, you know, every now and then on the weekends. Mm. Go down into the little basements where you buy shitty old PS2 games. And
oh, yeah, you remember it. Across the street from J&L.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah, yeah.
J&L is still standing. There's a Gunpla shop on that block, but that's really about it. Most of those places, especially that mall, just closed right up when Chinatown Fair closed. Wow. The block that Chinatown Fair is technically reopened, but it's kind of as like a shitty Dave and Buster's that only DDR people go to at all.
Oh.
So it's not really, I mean, it's a shell of itself.
There are still DDR people?
There are still DDR people. Let me tell you about the fact that there are still DDR people. All
right.
If you even stop by the current Chinatown Fair now, you'll see DDR people. The interesting thing about DDR people is that, like, you know how there's, like, that certain con person who kind of looks stuck in time a little bit? Like, they're fresh out of 2003.
Yeah,
and I'm sure
they're always, for some reason, they're into DDR, but they're wearing those Hot Topic bondage pants.
You know? Right, right. The Iori from KOF pants.
Yes, and that, and then they have like some big wolf tail on.
Right, and it's, I don't know, like, is that its own subculture? Like,
I guess they're like,
it's such a common uniform, and I don't think you can even really, can you find it at Hot Topic anymore? Hasn't even Hot Topic moved past this wardrobe? But
I don't know.
Who's left?
Yeah,
that's
like,
who's left.
Time stopped in 2005.
At DDR, really. At DDR, period, because it's not like a super popular game in Japan, I don't even think, anymore.
No.
Though they continue to make it, like, it's not a huge, you know. So, yeah, to close this whole thing about otaku shit in New York up is there's a reason we all go travel to East Coast cons. It's because there isn't a lot of that stuff, like, inside of New York City itself. Like, business is that niche, tend to be unable to pay the rent.
Does St. Mark's still have that toy store?
Toy Tokyo moved up off of St. Mark's.
Oh, okay.
St. Mark's is all like restaurants now, but the toy store still exists. Toy Tokyo still exists. I haven't been in years.
Right, because why bother?
Yeah, why bother? But actually, it is kind of, in retrospect, it is kind of a cool place to check out. Not so much to buy things because the prices are, you know, the prices are appropriate for a place paying rent in New York City, but it's more a museum space, like a lot of places around the city, like Video Games New York or 8-Bit and Up, both of which are retro game stores in the city, and one of them is on St. Mark's. They're museums. You don't really, like, go there and buy a thing. You just go there and look at the PS3 that Hideo Kojima signed, or Rob the Robot, or this game that calculates this handheld game that calculates odds for horse races.
Yeah, well, last time I was in Toy Tokyo, it was 2004, and I still have I bought a Panda Z while I was there. I still have it out today. But you're right, it was totally mostly an urban vinyl museum.
Oh, yeah, and, like, the vinyl is what actually sells there, so you mostly see those.
Yeah.
But the vinyl and super expensive, like, Real Action Heroes.
Yeah, they had a shit ton of, like, blind box Japanese figures and shit like that. Curious to know. Okay. So, Evan R. Jones asks, AM2 jokes, go.
I'm just so mad that Icon decided to take the name of my favorite video game developer, and I'll never forgive them for that, and even if I live next door to their con, I'd never go.
Well, they technically didn't. I said it wrong. It is supposed to be called AM Squared.
So it, still too close. Can't allow it.
Is AM Squared officially over with this year? They're not doing it?
Okay. So here's my understanding of this. That convention, to my knowledge, has been canceled. Now, I have been trying to get confirmation on this from Chase. You guys know Chase Wang.
For immediate release, yes.
For immediate release, Chase Wang. I've been trying to get him on the phone. Now, I've been good friends with Chase for going on 8-9 years. I can't get a hold of him. And I've been trying to put closure on this whole thing and get an official, yes, it's canceled. But basically everyone who volunteers for that or who is willing to say that they, you know, hey, I was volunteering for this convention, it's not happening this year. They're saying that it's not happening. So, yeah, it was scheduled to be the same weekend as Japan Expo USA, which is...
They did that again?
That's happening... well, they didn't do that
on purpose. Like, the scheduling.
I think they just didn't know about Japan Expo USA when they booked that weekend. They were like, this is far enough away from everything else. And then Japan Expo USA comes in, and they're like, oh. but I think maybe it's just like pre-registration numbers just weren't in the ballpark that they needed them to be. I mean, that's typically what gets a convention canceled, right? It's like pre-order numbers aren't there. So, you know, it's a shame. But to my knowledge, yes, that convention is not happening. However, I cannot say that definitively because I don't have an official answer from Chase right now. I don't like to make jokes about it because I don't want to see anyone fail like that. And
Well, it's unusual, too, for a convention to fail at this point. Like, it's not unusual, but it's not as common as it is, like, say, you know, releasing companies or things like that.
Right.
It seems like a lot of conventions actually still are relatively successful enough to maintain. And you think in Los Angeles, of all places, you'd be able to support a fair amount of competition, but...
You'd think...
Yeah, the con crowd has remained strong all these years, so it's just sort of sad.
Yeah, I mean, hey, some of you guys were at Anime Los Angeles, right?
Yep.
Yeah. Somehow that convention is growing. Okay, and lastly, also from Evan R. Jones, what's your take on retro-minded anime companies like Discotech and Made in Japan? Quick clarification of this. Made in Japan is not an anime company. It's a label from Section 23 / Sentai Filmworks / Acer Holdings / whatever other satellite company ADV Films set up.
Right.
They have done a remarkable...
The ADV universe.
They have done a remarkable job convincing people that these are separate companies and that it's not just ADV under a different name. But it is. It's just ADV under a different name. They are not like... It's not like a little startup with people who just... Oh, we just love anime. Like, it's ADV, guys. Like, it's a label. But, you know, that is what they're putting out all their retro stuff under. I don't know. Do you guys have thoughts on...
I mean, I don't understand quite how Discotech survives, but I think it's incredible and awesome that they do.
Well, I would imagine low print runs and inexpensive licenses.
Right. It still seems, I mean, I'm surprised that there aren't more companies taking that approach, but I think it's a good thing. I think it's cool that what they're doing.
I do too.
Yeah, I'm happy with
it. Yeah, I don't...
Yeah, regarding, like, Made in Japan, I saw they licensed a couple months ago Black Magic M66, and I'm just like, yeah, that show is kind of cool. Who the hell is going to buy that? Like, I think wasn't one of the big failings of ADV that they licensed these shows that nobody bought, and then, they might have learned their lesson, I guess, but then they licensed Black Magic M66? I mean, I can see that selling, what, 20 copies?
20 copies, yeah. Oh, right? 25. Well,
on a good day, yeah.
I guess, like, doing these little releases, speaking as an armchair anime businessman here, I guess doing these little releases is sort of in a different ballpark from, like, the ADV of the early 2000s, where they put all their, like, we're going to put it all behind Best Student Council, the huge hit, like, stuff like that. Or, like, we're going to redub Macross in its entirety. Why?
That actually did sell. Oh, no, not redubbing, but the...
Oh, didn't they redub the whole thing?
Yeah, I was thinking you're talking about the Animega release, but yeah, the ADV release didn't make any sense. Mm-hmm. But it did have Mariajima, so...
Well, this is the company that redubbed Grave of the Fireflies just to, you know, say they did it, I guess.
Oh, they have a lot of pride in them dubs, huh? I remember early Crunchyroll when they had both pirated and legit content, and ADV got on there. Everything, every single thing on Crunchyroll was subbed. That was like how it went. ADV was the one company that said, no, we're not going to, I'm going to give you a subtitled version of Welcome to the NHK, super popular otaku anime. Why would we do that? No. We are proud, and like they actually had like a press release where it was like, our signature accomplishment with Welcome to the NHK is the English dub. Therefore, we are only going to make it available. And there, you know, there was a minor fan kerfuffle, as there always is every week in anime. They just, they care about those dubs. They care about them so much that they don't want you to have an option.
Oh, that's not true.
Oh, not 100%.
All right, guys. Well, okay, so that wraps us up. Thanks, you guys, for coming on the show, and good luck with the zine.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks very much.
LikeoSean.com.
Okay, that's our show. Big thanks to Sean, Matt, and David for stopping by. The theme song is called Bucharest. It's by the band The New Division. You can check them out at newdivisionmusic.com. Don't forget, subscribe to us on iTunes, leave us a rating, a little review. We'd really appreciate it, and we'll see you all next week.